You're listening to How to Business, a podcast from the Small Business Development Center in Chattanooga, Tennessee. I'm Madison from the SBDC team, and today we will discuss playing the long game. In this episode, we'll be hearing from one of our counselors, Josh Brown, and his client, JJ German, owner of Office Furniture Warehouse.
JJ, thanks for joining us today. Hope you're having a great day. If you don't mind, take a couple moments, tell us about Office Furniture Warehouse, what it is, what your goals are, and kind of where you guys are going.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Josh. Thanks for this opportunity. Thank you for all the help you've been to our company and the Small Business Development Center as well. Well, interestingly enough, I got into this business sort of in a situation trying to solve a client problem. I used to practice architecture. We designed a lot of office space. I had a client during the internet bust that was shutting down a major operation that we had designed and planned for them. And I was trying to be a problem solver. What can we do to help you? Do you need to plan a new space or whatever? His biggest dilemma was, JJ, I got rid of all the people. I'm trying to get rid of the office space, but I've got all this furniture the landlord won't let me leave behind, and I've got to get it out. And I've got a quote for over $40,000 to remove $1.2 million worth of furniture. He says, I don't want to store it. I don't know if I'll ever redeploy it. I just need it out of the building. I said, that's a real dilemma. And I said, well, interestingly enough, I'm designing a project for another client that needs furniture. They might be interested in buying it. He said, listen, I don't even want any money for it. I just need it out of the building at no cost to me. I took that cue from him and I went, okay, well, I went to my client, showed him the furniture. They loved it. I suggested a price that they pay for it. They agreed to it. So they paid me for the furniture. I turned around and paid to have the furniture removed for my other client at no cost to them. At the end of the day, I sat down and looked at how much I made on that one deal. And I thought, wow, I got to get out of architecture. There's a business model here, I think. There really was a business model there because during the dot-com bust, there were companies just going out of business left and right and shutting down. All the venture capitalists' money had dried up. They had stopped funding businesses that were marginal and only putting money back behind businesses that were making money. There were furniture inventories I was liquidating that were 6 months, 8 months, a year old. In some cases, furniture that had never been sat in before. The hang tags were still on the chair. I got into that. I quit my job being an architect and designer and just started at that time just flipping inventories. I partnered up with a guy who do all the installation for me because I didn't have trucks, I didn't have warehouses, I didn't have any of that stuff. I was just working out of a spare bedroom in the house doing this on my computer. So he and I partnered up and we started a furniture dealership where we started buying some of these inventories and bringing them in and storing them and then reselling them. And that took off really well until about 07. We really started seeing the signs of the recession coming in Atlanta a little bit earlier, I think, than most places did. My daughter had started college. I decided to move back up to Tennessee. I had some family and friends up here. So I moved up here and opened up another dealership in 08, which was a great time to start a business during the recession because
obviously good times by all.
Yeah. The great thing about that was is because nobody was lending me money. I didn't have some bank or investor giving me a bunch of money that I had to worry about paying back. I had to do everything out of my own cash flow. And I would say the biggest takeaway for people listening today is financing still kind of hard to get. But if you can't get it, the best way to build your business is to build it out of your own cash flow because you'll be more cautious. You'll be more judicious about the risk you take. You'll be more calculated about the risk you take. And you'll be more judicious about how you spend your money and how it's going to benefit you. Today, yes, we do have a line of credit and we do have accessibility to funds that we didn't have before that gives us some flexibility. But I always think back to those days where if I wanted to buy a truck or hire somebody or buy a piece of equipment, I just had to look at the bank account and go, do I have enough money in the bank account to do that and still satisfy all my other debts and requirements? That really, I think, helped us grow in a very calculated way, in a very careful way.
Interesting. There's also some signs of that through the pandemic, too. What were businesses doing? How are they being judicious about their money? Let's not be entitled that the government owes us a whole ton of money kind of thing. It forces you really to kind of go back to basics. What am I doing? Where am I going? And let's not make ourselves crazy doing things or trying to do things. But by the same token, when you have struggles like that in the economy, there are opportunities. You turned lemons into lemonade just by starting the business, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, because even in 08, people did need furniture from time to time. Now, they probably weren't going to buy new furniture. And the fact that I was only selling at the time pre-owned furniture. Now, I do both. I do new and pre-owned today. But at that time, I only sold pre-owned furniture. So I was kind of the only game in town. If you wanted to use desk or use cubicle or use chair, and you don't want to spend $3,000 for a cubicle, but you're willing to spend $600 for a cubicle, then I was the guy to talk to. So that was the good business model to have. And that benefited us too. The economy always kind of readjusts itself. About every 7 years, there's some sort of recession or adjustment. When the economy's down and people are tight with their cash flow, they look more toward pre-owned. When things are good and prosperous and the economy's growing, then they tend to look for new. We had sort of the best of both worlds there that we're able to offer.
To this day, you've now since then bought your own building, so you have your own warehousing. You've got more stability, at least on the structure of the business, right?
Absolutely. And what's so interesting is when we started out, I don't think I told this part of the story. I started out in Cleveland, Tennessee. I started out in a gas station. They had three roll-up bay doors. They had taken the car lifts out of them, and I bought a tractor-trailer load of furniture and just filled up those three bays worth of used furniture and would drag it out on sunny days, and people would drive by, and hopefully they'd buy something. Of course, I was out marketing and talking to companies and whatnot, but I quickly realized that Cleveland was not the marketplace I needed to be in. I would talk to people in Chattanooga. They'd want to come see it, but because I was in Cleveland, you thought I would tell them I was in Atlanta. It's like, wow, well, I'm on my way up to the UT football game on Saturday. Can I stop by then? Kind of a conversation. So I moved into the Business Development Center, which is the best thing that could have happened to me. The good thing about it was is that the synergy of all these other people trying to start a business, and during a difficult time too, because I think I moved in 2009, 2010 timeframe, this economy still wasn't better. I mean, we're still trying to recover from that. But there were a lot of like-minded people all trying to do something creative, something interesting, something that would earn them a living and hopefully earn them the ability to retire. We had the Tennessee Small Business Development Center in there. So what a great resource to shorten your learning curve is to have people right there in the building that can help you avoid mistakes that people I see typically make day in and day out because they don't get the advice and counsel that they should be getting.
Thanks for that shameless plug.
Well, no, man, I'm just telling you like it is. And of course, you don't know my nickname for you. I tell people you're the Yoda of business. So you need to go see Yoda, a.k.a. Josh Brown. But it makes a difference. I mean, it's always been important to me in my life to have mentors. And if you don't have a mentor, then at least get somebody that's in an organization or an environment that can help support you. Because there are a lot of things that you just don't know. I went to architecture school. They don't teach you about business. They teach you about architecture, period. All your classes, everything's devoted to architecture. So just like physicians, they all come out being really good at their craft, but they don't know anything about business. So you either learn it the hard way or you learn it the smart way. And if you're going to learn it the smart way, you surround yourself with people that know what they're doing and can give you good advice.
That's a great point. You come out of college thinking you know everything, and then suddenly you realize, I'm stupid about business. It's really a big learning curve, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Well, to that end and kind of moving forward, one of the reasons I reached out to you to have this discussion is you have gone, as you have said, look, we went through the 07 to 10 to 12, that kind of chaos in the economy and what people were doing. But yet you keep adding and creating opportunities, whether it's the office furniture that you're buying and selling or that you have the moving or the other projects that you're working on. So my first question is, how have you created milestones and exit strategies for the business and yourself?
I think in order to create milestones, you really have to start with the basics, and you got to start with the business plan. So we did start out, I always was a big believer in that, creating a business plan. And through that product, you help identify certain milestones you want to create, whether it's revenue objectives, whether it's about your facility, infrastructure, your labor, your equipment, whatever it may be. The business plan gives you the structure, which how you're going to grow the business. Now, what are the certain key accomplishments you need to achieve in order for that business plan to come to fruition? I think that was the right step for us to take, and that helped us plan. Now, there's some things that I did not imagine. When I was in a 3,000 square foot gas station, I never imagined I'd be in an 80,000 square foot warehouse. My milestone then was at some point I'm going to have a 20 or 30,000 square foot warehouse. And the Lord works in mysterious ways, and here I am in an 80,000 square foot warehouse, but which was a good thing for me because I'm able to lease out a portion of it that I don't really need, but it helps me cover my expenses on the building and other operational expenses. That was really sort of a godsend opportunity to have a bigger building because it sort of helps subsidize and push our business forward in a very economical way. Then just having a strategy where you listen to your customers. In all those things you name that we do, we have my chair doctor division, we have the medical division, we have the moving division, we have storage. I wish I could say I came up with that all by myself, but actually I spent time listening to customers and listening to their pain points. I think that's where we have benefited in our growth is that we, like I told you earlier, when I first started the story, I was in architecture and I was a problem solver. And that was me with the client that had a problem, need to get rid of furniture. Mm-hmm. Well, that's how I approach my business today is I'm a problem solver. I listen to what problems customers have and then what service or product do we have to address that. Now, the pitfall that some people make is they try to jump into things that are not their areas of expertise or core competency. So if a client's having issues with electrical and lighting and painting and can't find a contractor and all that, no, I'm not a general contractor. But if it has to do anything with furniture, then I'm your guy. Whether you need to replace it, repair it, sell it, reupholster it, touch it up, or store it, I'm the guy that can do all that for you. So what I started doing is listening to customers, and when they'd say, gee, do you think you know anybody that can do this? Well, if it fits in my wheelhouse, as a good entrepreneur, you always say, yes, even if you don't know how to do that yet. So my first experience of that with people had pneumatic lift chairs that were sinking, and they said, do you think you can do anything to keep that chair from sinking, put a new lift in it or something like that? And my first response was, yeah, of course we can. We can get that done for you. Then I spent time researching it and sure enough found resources and people that knew how to do that. That birthed a whole new division called My Chair Doctor. We work with all kinds of major companies, and when they get 20, 30, 40 chairs that go down for whatever reason, missing arm cap, damaged arm cap, lifts, casters, whatever it may be, we pick them up, we refurbish them, send them back, and they redeploy them as opposed to buying a whole brand new chair. So there's a real green element to what our company is. We really do believe in sustainability. We feel like products that are really made well, if we can keep them operational and in the work environment, that's part of our contribution to helping the planet and helping to keep things out of the landfill.
That's really good to hear, not only that you're taking your approach to what are we doing to help to sustain our environment. You made a comment earlier about, yeah, of course I can fix that, and then you got to go figure out how to do it. But the thing I keep telling my clients on a regular basis is they don't know what I don't know. They only know what I tell them. So if you don't know it, you got some time to figure it out, right?
That's great. I love that.
And that's such a great point that you're saying, look, I'm a problem solution provider, not buy my widget, buy my chair, buy my coffee mug. It's I'm here to give you a place to sit and have a hot cup of coffee kind of thing.
That's a great point you make about that too, about being a problem solver, because I fight constantly because I sell a commodity, and there are a lot of good companies here in town that can sell you a chair, a desk, a file cabinet, whatever. But I fight constantly that I'm this commodity provider, and I really want to be a partner to you in your business. I want to help you make good decisions that benefit your business. And if I can take 1 second to tell a really quick story to that effect, I had a client that wanted me to buy some cubes they weren't going to use anymore in another location. In the meantime, I had given them a proposal for about $68,000 for a new installation of cubes. And when I started looking at the cubes they want to get rid of, I said, well, why aren't you just using these in this other location? And they said, well, we don't think they'll work. They're not the right size. So we're just going to get rid of them and buy new ones. As I inventoried it, I looked at it, I determined that they really could reconfigure those cubes for that other location. So I did a floor plan, I did a drawing, showed it to them. I said, hey, look, you can use these cubes. This is how they would work. And they were like, wow, we didn't think that would happen. So, well, what would that cost? And I said, well, that's $18,000 versus $68,000. They took that to the board, and because this was not a revenue-producing area of the company, it was more of an overhead area, they were like, fantastic, let's do it. Let's take the cubes out of the old office and put them in this other location. Did we leave $50,000 on the table? Yes, we did. But did we build a relationship with the client that feels like, hey, if we have a question or not sure what decision to make about furniture, what direction to go in, let's call OFW and let's talk to them and see what their thoughts are on it.
I want every salesperson to hear that discussion point, because I don't know about you, but we talk to salespeople all day, every day, and all they can think about is pushing their product, not about how their product can help change relationships and trust and growth and long-term solution. That's such a great point. So I'll leave that there for a moment. And if you don't mind, I'm going to jump ahead a little bit. How did you balance risks to grow your business and then determine when it's the time to make bold moves?
To balance risk, I think I told you earlier, we grew out of cash flow. So We didn't have the resources where we just keep pulling money out of some account to do things only to find out they're not going to work. And then we're upside down or sideways. So we were very cautious about what new ventures we took on. Even when we took on the My Chair Doctor business, we made sure that we understood what was involved in doing that work. What were the costs of those products and services we're providing, and what kind of margin could we put on it to make it a moneymaker? Because if you're doing something that what you're charging is almost equal to what your costs are, then you're just working to be working. It had to show that it could be a moneymaker, we could get good revenues off of it, and it could be repeatable, and that we could measure it too. So those were some of the key decisions we made, I think, in terms of how we went forward. And then, like I said, we were very careful about doing things that were core to our business. If it didn't have anything to do with furniture, we didn't really want to jump into it and start offering it. We'll have clients that say, do you have catalogs for light fixtures and lighting and things of that nature? No, we don't. We don't get involved in lighting. We don't make recommendations on it. We don't do anything with regard to that because that's not our core business. We don't understand it, and we don't have the resources for, like, installation of it. But anything you buy from us for furniture or need reconfigured or moved or stored or taken apart or whatever, I have those resources. I have those people with those talents and skill sets to effectively make those changes or reconfigurations. And I think just letting the clients kind of drive what their needs are. I think if you're always listening to your client and looking for that pain point that particular client's having, simple things like getting keys for file cabinets. I have so many clients that were frustrated about having to pay a locksmith $90 for a site visit to come make a key for a file cabinet. I found a resource where I can get keys for most office furniture. It's probably around $15 a key versus $90 plus the cost to make the key from a locksmith. Now, there are occasions when you need a locksmith and they're great to have, and they do a great job. But for most furniture, if I can get the lock code off the core where you put the key in, there's usually some letters and numbers. If I get that and I know who the manufacturer of the furniture is, I can probably get you a key for under $20.
I want to back up a second because you made a comment about what's the core of my business. And I know the core discussion here is long-term viability and strategic planning. But I think you almost want to back up to a really important point that you've said a couple of times, which is, what is the mission of my business? And when I'm looking at other things and other products and strategies or whatever the case may be, does it speak to the core of what I'm doing and where I want to go? I really want to emphasize, when I talk with you, I'm sure you and I will agree that I've asked you this no less than 5 or 10 times, is what's the mission and what is it that which you want to do? Is it core to your mission? You really have embraced that within your business. I encourage a lot of other businesses to think that way. Do you really know where you're going and how you're going to get there? What is it I want to be? Because I can't be everything to everybody. And I really want to make sure that from an office furniture side, I'm going to be the best I can be. I'm going to beat all of my competitors, not necessarily on product, but on perceived value and service and those things. That will naturally carry all the other stuff. You really do a good job of that. I would give you big pats on the back for that. You're core to your mission, and that's awesome.
Yeah, and I think that your point you're making is, yes, I'm in one of those professions that is very much a commodity. I mean, people look at 4 desk chairs or task chairs, and one's $600 and one's $100. Well, you can both sit on them. They both roll. They both tilt. They both swivel. Why should I pay $600 for one and $100 for another? That's the thing I fight constantly, is that we want to be a provider, not to sell you the most expensive item, but sell you the item that is right for you and what you need. When you come in and say you want a particular thing, we're not going to pull out the order form and write it up. We're going to say, well, how are you using this? What do you use it for? Is this something you're going to sit at all day? Is this something that you're going to work at all day? What's your thoughts behind it? So we can make sure that they've made a good decision, or maybe should consider some other alternatives that might be better. And some of those might be less expensive, like you saw in the illustration I just gave you about the cubes, where we said you can reuse those. You don't have to get rid of those, which was a $50,000 savings of that company. So when you start helping companies save that kind of money in their cash flow, you can become more of a partner and less of a vendor.
Yeah, but as a sales guy, I want to respond to that $100 chair versus a $600 chair. And my immediate knee-jerk reaction is to say something to the customer along the lines of, you know what, that guy selling a $100 chair, he's smart. He knows what his product's worth. And just let that set for a second, because people go, wait, what's wrong with the $100 chair versus the $600 chair? They're like, oh, well, then I got to spend more money for a chair, because evidently the $100 chair is going to fall apart on me a week from Tuesday, and then I'm going to be where I'm at.
And I think the other thing you have to realize in business, not every person is your customer. And I do have people that walk in sometimes, and they've been to the big box stores, and I might be selling a used Herman Miller chair, an Aeron chair. I think a lot of people are familiar with those, with the mesh back and seat. Those probably retail for anywhere from $800 to $1,000, and I might be selling them for $450. And they're like, well, shoot, I can go to XYZ off a supply store and get 4 at $75 a piece and still be less than the cost of that chair. And absolutely, you can. Yeah, absolutely. But if that's your budget, that's where you're at in your business, that's okay. At some point, if your business business takes off and you've got more money to spend and you want something that's going to be more durable and last, then you might be my customer. I try to get people not to get frustrated trying to make everybody that walks in our customer, because not everybody's going to be our customer.
I think that's very cogent. Not everybody's going to be your customer. Not everybody buys a Cadillac that wants to buy a Hyundai or a Toyota. Everybody has their different flavors. You can't be everything to everybody. That actually brings me up to, when you're saying not everybody's my customer, how do you create resiliency within your business that has allowed you to adapt to threats or changes or chaos in the marketplace?
That's a good question. On a couple of levels, one, I guess from a cash flow perspective, we've always been conscious of cash flow, so we've been careful about not getting ourselves overextended. We've always tried to be forward thinking and looking at the marketplace and trying to make the right decision in what products and things that we bring in that are going to be appealing to people, and how to cope with global economic conditions. For example, there's some products we were bringing in that came from China, but when the China tariffs hit, we saw that was starting to negatively impact shipping as well as cost of products. So we resourced and found some entities in Eastern Europe that could provide us furniture that was as good or not better quality than what we'd been getting before. And so we switched. We did a pivot, I guess, in terms of our supplier, and went to the European market where we didn't have the tariff. And we got really a kind of a nicer looking product. It has more detail in it, built very well. And that really helped us because we had a good price point on it. We were able to keep our prices reasonable where other people were having to raise their prices because of tariffs. But it didn't put us into a situation where it overextended us, because we knew what we could afford to buy, and that's all we took off. We didn't sign up to buy 10 containers. We signed up to buy one or two containers of furniture. We made sure that we bought the product mix that we typically see our customers looking for, which was L-desk and file pads and certain kinds of chairs and certain kinds of cubicles. We're doing that today. It's sort of a constant thing that you're always looking at. How can I continue to provide the level of service and products, but do it in the most cost-effective way so I'm not having to raise prices? And so now we're starting a program where we're going to stock cubicles, which means the cubicles are pre-finished and they're in parts and pieces, but they're sitting on our warehouse racking. Where typically when somebody buys a cubicle, they get to pick out the fabric, the trim color, the laminate color. Well, that's a 4 to 6 week lead time to get those cubes. Now, with all the container issues, you could be looking at 8 to 12 weeks to custom order a cube. But we're going to stock cubes on our shelves that are ready to pull off the shelf and put together and build in your workspace. Now, the one thing is, you can get the panel fabric in gray, or you can get it in gray, or you can get it in gray. But that's the point. It's already pre-made. Nobody having to fabricate the metal frame, nobody's having to put the fabric on it, nobody's having to paint the trim. It's all done. It's all sitting there ready to go. So for an organization that doesn't want to wait 8 to 12 weeks and wants to be up and running, especially if getting people in place is going to generate revenue from them, every day that they don't have people working is a day they're not creating more revenue. If we can, in 72 hours, have cubes available, then I think that's a real positive for people whose businesses are trying to grow or trying to pivot to respond to their changing business needs. Because we certainly pivoted during the COVID situation. I mean, when March came, there were all kinds of clients calling us up. We had projects saying, hey, we got to put that on hold. We got to pump the brakes on this. We're not sure what's going to happen with our employees, how long they're going to be out. We got hit pretty hard, but we pivoted. Now, Josh, you're going to look at me and go, yeah, but that's not core to your business, what you did. Well, it's core to my philosophy about solving problems for clients. I do a lot of work in the healthcare industry, and I had a lot of healthcare clients, more so the clinics and the private practices, that couldn't get masks. The hospitals could get masks, but the private practices couldn't get masks. So I've got a buddy that lives over in South America who's got some China contacts, and we imported and brought over several hundred thousand masks that we were able to sell to all these customers that we have that are private practitioners in the healthcare arena as a way just to kind of keep people busy, give them something to do, generate a little bit of cash flow. I mean, certainly didn't make money for us like selling furniture did, but at least it kept sort of the machine slightly loose. So it didn't.
Kept cash flowing. And it kept doctors looking at you or the medical practitioners going, these guys helped set me up.
We took the problem they had. It didn't have anything to do with furniture, exam tables that we do, or exam stools, or anything like that. But it had to do with the product they needed. We found a resource for, and we were able to get it and get it to them. That's a pivot, and of course that's kind of an extreme sort of pivot. Normally you'd think of something that's more related to the furniture that you might do, but times like that, nobody's ever experienced a pandemic like that before. Sometimes you've got to do things a little bit outside your normal realm of scope of work.
What I liked about one of the comments that was rattling around in my brain is you're saying, look, instead of going to China and desperately beating the trees in China to get furniture to me, I looked at Eastern Europe, and all of a sudden my brain, I'm like, all right, we don't have the bottlenecks of shipping in and out of China and in and out to the West Coast. Now it's coming in on the East Coast, which means shipping time should take a fraction of the time comparatively, because there's just this ongoing supply chain issues coming in and out of the Far East. To a degree, I would presume this kind of helps that problem, right?
It does. It does. And that supply chain issue, people don't realize. I get articles and information all the time about this, but that supply chain had been so tightly designed with very little give in it for any disruption that some people are saying it may take 2 years for the container supply chain to work itself out and get straightened out, because it was on such a fine-tuned process that having that COVID situation when ports were closed, containers weren't going out, containers weren't coming in. I mean, there's a bidding war for containers, and stuff that used to ship for $2,000 to $3,000 is shipping for $11,000 to $14,000 now.
Which eats into everybody's profit. So I get that. It's one of those challenges you got to deal with.
Our resiliency is based on understanding our cash flow, making sure we don't extend ourselves, and then hiring the right people. I tell you what, hiring the right people in order to ensure the long-term success of your company is so critical. I guess I'll put it this way. I kissed a whole lot of frogs before I found the right princes and princesses to help me run the company. And I've got just an exceptional team now of people that are really astute, really understand our business model, understand our mission and goals, what we want to achieve. Those people and their work ethic is really what helped support us and get us through this difficult time we had during COVID. I will say now things are much better, but having the right people, I brought on a CFO that used to be a former banker. And I can tell you, Josh, you being a former banker yourself, when I go in and have a meeting with a banker, it's like I'm listening to somebody speak a foreign language sometimes. And then I bring in my CFO, who is a former banker, and they start talking, and they start talking their own language. And it's amazing what happens in those meetings.
You just turn and grunt and shake your head occasionally like you know.
I don't say a word. I just sit there and nod.
Knowingly,
When my guy makes a good point, I go, yeah, I think he's right. But the idea of having a really great relationship with your bank, and we had a relationship with the bank that we started out with almost from the beginning. Sometimes I call it, and you're from the banking industry, maybe you can understand this, I call it sometimes a 7-year itch, where for 7 years you were the ideal customer and they love you and they like you and they don't ever want to break up with you. And then someday they're like, yeah, we don't like you as much as we used to.
It's not you, it's me.
But we've been fortunate. We've got a great bank we work with now and they've been fantastic to us. What I really was looking for in a banking relationship too was somebody that would kind of be our partner, would be taking interest in our business. How are things going? How are sales? How are revenues? How's operations? What are you doing to enhance your business? One of the things we're trying to do, we haven't really talked about exit strategy, but Lord knows I don't want to do this forever. Two things I started implementing about 3 years ago. One was try to automate as much stuff as we could. So this thing could be almost on autopilot from a procedural operational standpoint. I mean, salespeople, the sales process is a little more personal and different. You can't so much automate that, but you can automate some portions of how you get leads. But just the creating orders, creating invoices, creating quotes, inventorying product, tracking product, work orders for installations, all that we can automate. So I've been trying to automate as much of the company as I can, and we made good progress on that. Then I brought in somebody that I could start grooming to take my place. He and I are on a multi-year track here for me to try to brain dump as much valuable information as I have left to give, and that seems to be decreasing every day for some reason, but I'm trying to pass on as much as I can so that he's prepared and has a good understanding of what he needs to do and has the resources to tackle problems moving forward. I am working on an exit strategy, and I think anybody who starts a company, after your first 5 years, you're up and running, you're making money, you ought to start thinking then about how are you going to exit out of your business, because I don't want JJ to be totally the persona of OFW. I don't want it to be just about me, because if I go away, then that may be a negative impact. I want OFW to have its own reputation and can be sustaining for whoever runs it going forward. I also need to be working to build value in the business. When I go to exit, I want it to be really worth more than it is today when we're talking. that benefits me and my retirement and my future as well. So there's a lot of things that you got to think about. And if you decide one day, I think I want to sell the business, if you're going to sell it tomorrow, then it's going to be a fire sale. You're not going to get what it's worth. No one's going to want to buy it because you don't have the systems in place to keep it running like it was before. They're just buying a hot mess.
That is such an alien concept to a lot of people. They get into a business because they have a passion or they feel like they have a widget that everybody wants, but they don't have that, all right, I'm willing to do this for the next 5 years, 10 years, and then I either want to go to the farm or I want to start my next chaotic mess and find whatever that is. That's such a powerful comment, JJ, that you're like, I got to have my exit strategy. What do I want to do and how do I want to get there and how do I create that additional value? I think the pandemic kind of laid that bare to a lot of people that what they thought was valuable in their company may or may not actually be the case. You need to take those few minutes to go, all right, what is really valuable here that is an ongoing commodity to sell later? Those are really good points. I'm so glad that you're so dialed into that because, gosh, that just seems to be one of the things that our business owners forget is, okay, I'm in the middle of it today, tomorrow, and the next day, but what am I looking at 2 years from now or 4 years from now? I'm glad you take that approach. It's actually one of the reasons why when I was looking at all of the clients I work with, your name jumped out at me as this discussion point because you have that kind of vision of, I'm not going to be doing it for the rest of my life. I'm just going to do it for the time being and then I'm going to figure out next steps.
I think that's pretty common. I will say I have to give credit back to you guys as well because you got me involved in a program several years back called 10KSB, Goldman Sachs program. One of our sessions was based on exit strategy, and that really got me to thinking about, yeah, if I'm going to do this, how do I do this in a systematic way as opposed to just announcing one day, hey, I want to sell the place, who wants to buy it? Well, A, are there any buyers for it? And secondly, what's the company worth and what kind of position is it in? Going through that program, 10KSB program, was really beneficial to me on a lot of levels in helping me think about exit strategy and how to prepare for that in a meaningful way.
Well, thanks, JJ. I just have one more question for you. What is the one piece of advice that you would give to other business owners?
I will say the one thing I would give advice on that I probably didn't do as well as I should have is getting the right people on your staff. And as soon as you find out they're not right, making that change. I think there's a slogan out there. It's slow to hire and fast to fire. I would definitely follow that mindset. And the second one, I guess, if I had to throw a second point out there, don't skimp on getting good financial guidance and help, like in your accounting, your books and stuff, because if that gets messed up, doesn't matter how profitable and how well you're running the rest of your business, that can really get you sideways. So spend the money, hire good people to do your finances and your legal, and then be slow to hire and quick to fire. Because you got to keep that ship running as efficiently as possible. And if you have a person on board that's not doing what you need them to do, then you got to find that person. And it's hard in today's market. I'll tell you, we're struggling finding people today to help us, but we keep looking.
But you've already got to that point on the hiring side. You already have identified the type of candidate you're looking for, so you can be more intentional in your approach. But when it comes to hiring the right professionals, what is the term that people use? If you think hiring a professional is expensive, what's it going to be like when you have an amateur doing it for you? It's just going to be way more expensive in the long term anyway.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. Yeah, if you get cheap and you hire somebody that's inexpensive or whatever and they don't know what they're doing, the cost to unwind all that and fix it, you're to save money by hiring a more expensive person from the get-go.
Kind of like buying a $600 chair instead of a $100 chair.
There you go.
JJ, thank you for your time. Thank you for being part of How To Business.
Well, thank you, Josh, and thanks for all the help and support that Small Business Development Center has been to us. We really appreciate it, and we're better for it. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to How To Business, a podcast by the Small Business Development Center in Chattanooga, Tennessee. If you like today's episode, we invite you to subscribe to our podcast and to take a moment and rate it on the mainstream podcast platforms. The How To Business podcast is produced by Pod Topics in collaboration with the SBDC of Chattanooga. To learn more about Pod Topics, visit podtopics.com.